Okay, yeah, Truth About Markets time here on Residence 104.4. Max and Stacy, you know, Stacy, I get that email from the Naked Short Club, another show here in Residence 104.4, and with every passing month, you know, that show is becoming more and more important because they just get into the real deal.
Yes, because of course it is Naked Shorts.
Yeah, you know, when they started that show, everybody, or I should say nobody really understood what a naked short sale was. And now it's on everybody's tongue, including the folks over there in Germany who run that country because they're banning naked short selling. Of course, this show is not going to be banned. Now the show is more important than ever.
That's right. And it is actually quite captivating. It's like artwork listening to it. It's like listening to a play by Pinter or something.
Yeah, that's a good one to listen to after this show, especially if you've been smoking bongs during the entire duration of this show. Then if you listen to that show, I guarantee that you'll have an ecclesiastical revelation displayed before your unconscious mind in real time, and then you'll probably see the mirror image of Jesus as he's parading down the Champs-Élysées with a brand new cake from the Sugar Plum Cake Shop. By the way, Stacy, we have a winner. You know, I think it was a week ago or so, we told folks to send an email to the Sugar Plum Cake Shop in Paris for a guillotine cake, and somebody did, and somebody won, and they are now the winner of a guillotine cake from the Sugar Plum Cake Shop. I don't have any more details than that because I was just over there before coming over here to do this. And what the gals told me over there, there's three women who run that Sugar Plum Cake Shop, brand new cake shop here in Paris. And they told me that they're working on getting the spirit of the decline of the empire, the American empire, going back to the fall of the Roman Empire. They're creating some kind of Bacchanalian multi-layer orgy cake.
What?
Yeah. It's going to have, it's going to be like those vases you see in Roman antiquities of the Romans engaging in all manner of bacchanalia and, you know, let's call it what it is, copulation. And so they're going to recreate this, I guess, in icing and cake. And, you know, just let the imagination run wild.
Of course, on those vases from the Roman Empire, all the the figures engaged in all sorts of orgies and vomitoriums were very lithe creatures.
Well, that comes with the Depression, doesn't it? You know, that's one of the benefits of a depression in America is that people are losing weight. They had a severe obesity problem there. They have one now, especially down in Louisiana. It's one of the worst states in the country in terms of obese and morbidly obese. Now with the twin disasters of the Hurricane Katrina and the new BP oil holocaust, the people are losing weight. So there's an upside to it. You don't need, who's that perky guy?
Yeah, but at first it's like, it's just, I guess, middle class people who lose the weight first. Yes. I mean, because poor people eat, are fed food that isn't actually really food. And it's only beginning to emerge as a common consensus that obviously processed food actually is not food. There's no nutrients in it, and therefore you become very fat from it.
It's glue, actually.
Obesity is actually malnutrition. But the middle class people who are used to eating fruits and vegetables and real meat and stuff like that, they're the ones losing weight. We've heard, who is it we spoke to recently? They were saying that their friend lost a couple many pounds. We have a friend who also had a hard time when all his credit cards were cut off and he lost like 80 pounds.
That's right. It's the Visa credit card cutoff diet.
Yeah.
That's right. And you're right. Most of the food is processed food and it's based on the original recipe that's used by the Elmer Glue Company. I remember when I was in elementary school, we used to eat Elmer's glue all the time. And then
is so weird.
Oh, yeah. We had another glue there called Tritex, which I remember in kindergarten, it was first grade, the art teacher there, Mr. Scott, would say, a dab will do you. You know, you only need to put a little of this glue on the construction paper to create your, you know, whatever it is you're working on there. Now, of course, if you roll it between your fingers, you can create very artistically rendered, verisimilitude sculptures of snot.
Yes,
which you
yes.
can then pretend to pull out of your nose to horrify and everyone around you. The Tritex snot sculptures.
Yes, all the little boys in our art class would have these snot sculptures.
Mm-hmm,
we,
mm-hmm.
on the other hand, that we little girls were just sniffing it on the other side of the room.
Glue sniffers. Well, that would be airplane glue, of course. It's a different kind of a glue. And, of course, those well-known to listeners here at Residence 104.4 who are avid airplane glue sniffers. You know, it's kind of a cheap high if you can't afford methamphetamine or Drano.
It's the processed food of the glue sniffing world.
Cheap get high. I noticed that Kate Moss is on a lot of magazine covers this week. I saw her on cover of the magazine section of Libération here in Paris, all half naked with her breast exposed, with the caption "Animal."
The French they really like her here.
Well, why not? She's got perky breasts, and okay. I'm up for that. You know. I mean, let's talk areola size just for a moment. I know we've beaten it to death, but Kate Moss has what I would consider to be small size areolas, something in the order of maybe the size of a 2 pound coin, maybe in between a 1 and 2 pound coin, which I'm a big fan of. I got to admit, I'm not a big. I don't like those big, you know, coasters. Coaster size areolas.
Okay, honey. Yeah. This is the truth about markets, okay? Are you talking about the porn market or what?
Well, you know,
the luxury goods market?
Now that Cantor Fitzgerald's going to introduce Box Office Futures Exchange, and that's coming at the end of the month, even though we've lobbied the Motion Picture Association of America and the CFTC to block it, I would remind people or alert people that I own the URL for pornfutures.com. Mm-hmm. So once they start trading Indiana Jones Part 4, Batman Part 6, futures contracts, you know, they'll be ready to trade Emmanuel Part 3 and the Green Door, Behind the Green Door Part 7, porno futures contracts. So you can go long porno and, you know, short Christian-themed movies. For example, if you wanted to arbitrage moral perspicuity in the America, for example. And I'm not even sure perspicuity is a word, but...
Well, you could go long Christian porn. I'm sure there are, you know, the porn industry is very fast moving and rip off cultural themes very quickly. I'm sure they already have their...
Christian porn is a growth industry. You
priestly
know,
porn.
There was Christian rock and roll. And, you know, now there'll be Christian porn, I'm sure, to fill the gap. And I think leading the way there would be His Holiness Pope Benedict, the current Pope, who's certainly, diddling his way to infamy with what's been happening over there in the Vatican.
Okay, well, first, should we talk a little bit about politics or a little bit about finance and markets? Or? Well, actually, you were just talking about France and how Kate Moss is big here. So
yeah, Kate Moss. She's small, but she's big.
So let's talk about SocGen, Société Générale.
Oh, my
their
God.
Share price plummeted on Friday as there were rumors of a huge derivatives loss, which also happened to coincide with the announcement by the Hungarian president that, what was his quote, that basically... they're bust.
Right.
And so there is some speculation that this, you know, SocGen, which could have a huge exposure because many of the big banks in Germany and France, but in particular, Austria, have huge exposure to Hungary and Eastern Europe.
That's right. SocGen is a big European bank. It's a big French bank. Rumor, they got big exposure to, I guess, the derivatives market.
Yeah, they are a massive derivatives player and are integral to a lot of the fraud around the world in the last, which has emerged in the last few years.
It's been going since on. The 2007 August revelation by BNP that they were no longer going to value these derivatives on their books at 100 cents on the dollar. This was the precipitous moment that began what we now call the credit crisis, global depression 2.0.
But the point is that it seems like the next wave of it's kind of like this controlled demolition. Every few months we get a new announcement that there's another big shocking derivatives loss. The markets tumble, wealth is evaporates, and then things stabilize for a few months. Everybody starts to get high again very quickly, saying, "Woohoo, the bubble's back." And they get all complacent. And then,
to use the modern parlance of the hedge fund industry, risk on.
Risk on. And then, of course, then they make another announcement of another massive losses.
Yes, it's all part of my unified inflation-deflation theory. And it's all part and parcel of the history of markets over the past 30 years and 50 years and 200 years, and really going back further than that. In 2007, you made a transition from a 25-year bull market, which was net inflationary, to now the beginning of a multi-year bear market, which is net deflationary. The problem with the market starting in 2007 and continuing to right now is deflation. And this caught many people off guard because they correctly predicted that when the credit bubble popped in 2007, that central banks would flood the markets with more fiat currency, and that, but they incorrectly predicted this would cause inflation because the money that was created never circulated. It never was became subject to the forces of velocity, as this term is used in the banking circles. And instead, it simply has been going into a black hole to try to write down these massive debts. And so far, as we have discovered every month, the phenomenon that you're alluding to is that with every $1 trillion of fresh fiat capital that is injected into the corpse through transfusion of central bank machinations, there is a revelation of $2 trillion in heretofore undisclosed bad debts. And that net-net equals deflation.
Deflation. And deflation, of course, only can happen if there was a inflation of bad debts in the first place.
Right. Well, that's the pyramid scheme or the Ponzi scheme that, you know, getting into the multi-decade historical timeline here, you had Alan Volcker, who preceded Alan Greenspan, raise the interest rates, the Fed funds overnight lending rate, to the high teens, which cut the supply line of cheap money into the inflationary Ponzi scheme that was running rampant and causing the U.S. economy and the U.S. dollar grave harm. Now, then Alan Greenspan took over, and in the early, let's call it the mid-1980s, mid-1980s, he took over and began basically through what's now known as Reaganism, Thatcherism, neoliberalism, Milton Friedmanism, Washington Consensusism, to keep chopping at rates for 25 years. And even though there were two times or three times when, if the central bank were acting prudently, they would have raised rates to snuff out an incipient bubble, the dot-com bubble, the housing bubble, for two very obvious examples, and the collapse of long-term capital management being another one. But they failed to do what they are chartered to do, and the result is simply kicking the can down the road until 2007, when finally the ecology of the global financial system could not absorb any more toxic fiat currency risk spilling. And it became terminal, it became fatal. And so now you've entered into what Hyman Minsky predicted and talked about in his work after the so-called Minsky moment. When now in current times, you've got Michael Hudson, who's a fine economist who we interview on our show often, who makes the very basic point that no debts can be paid that can't be paid. You know, there's still trillions of dollars of debts and they won't be paid because they can't be paid. The debt service is now, in the U.S., 90% of GDP, a debt-to-equity ratio, debt service-to-equity ratio skyrocketing. GDP cannot grow because the debt service is too high. So you've gone into terminal velocity of a deflationary depression nightmare. And it won't stop until all this bad debt is finally revealed. And that could take 2 or 3 years. It could take, in the case of Japan, you know, they've been talking about it now for 20 years. So, but it won't stop. There's no way now to create a new phase to the bubble economy that will keep intact what we've seen going back to 20, 25 years. Now, another interesting point, sub-point, is that 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the group that calls themselves the inflationists, which includes Jim Rogers, Peter Schiff, Max Keiser was in that camp for about 6 months before I was educated by Mike Shedlock.
Eric Jansen,
Jim Poplava, King,
Eric King.
Okay, all these people were inflationists and were recommending to sell your U.S. government bonds, and that the government bonds were the worst possible thing. You would get massacred, and it turns out that was actually one of the best things you could have done, and they had been completely wrong. So, and they are completely wrong today. Well, I see that on my Bloomberg machine. One of the only things up on Friday was TLT, the exchange traded fund for 10-year U.S. government treasury bonds, was up 2%. You know, getting close to 52-week highs. That's not the result of inflation. Inflation has been the problem. The only now we get into really the sub point, which is very interesting for you who are still scrounging around trying to roll a joint out of seeds and stems, having sold all the good stuff to your cousin's nephew, brother-in-law's sister, in exchange for some rank piece of apple pie. The connection between gold going up and the dollar going up at the same time. Okay, now again, the same inflationists were saying that gold and dollar trade in an inverse way. Dollar would crash, gold would go up. Well, here we have a deflation environment where dollar and gold is going up. So this is, again, this is a very interesting, the most interesting aspect of the global markets right now would be the twin rise of gold and the dollar. And it goes back to the fact that gold has made a transition from being considered a commodity to being considered a currency.
Well, I want to bring up, tie a few of these things that you're talking about into one story that I've just read, yeah, which is interesting, because you talk about gold and the dollar, you mentioned Michael Hudson, and you talk about the growth of the financial derivatives. Now, we interviewed Michael Hudson just yesterday, and for our next episode of the Keiser Report, which comes out late Monday night, it'll be on YouTube by Tuesday. But he mentions this rentier economy,
yeah,
that basically we've all been occupied in a way very similar to what the early economic progressive of, like, Adam Smith being one of the first of them, where they were totally against rentier economies, and how monopolists were able to extract huge amount excessive rent out of the population and basically keep them in debt peonage. Now, The Economist magazine has an article here, Time for a Rent Cut, saying supporting exactly what Michael Hudson says, controlling the finance sector's excessive returns. And it goes back to gold, because this is when they don't mention gold, but this is when they say it all starts, when we broke the gold standard. So points out that the return on equity achieved by British banks averaged around 7% between 1921 and 1971. Since then, it has averaged around 20%. And then they go over the causes of this, including, the subsidy by the taxpayer, basically, in the government support for banks, and where they get the low cost of capital and then get to lend it to you at a very high rate.
Right.
the consolidation of these big banks. But another thing that they blame it on is the complex products that has made it less, given less transparency to customers, making it hard to judge the price that they are being charged. And another, and the final thing they address is this notion that you always talk about is churn. They talk about the surge in trading volumes is also significant. At every stage, the finance industry takes a cut in the form of a bid offer spread, a fee, or a commission. This churning is a classic rent seeking activity. So he's taught what to do about it. They say is that basically the most participants in the market are via some giant pension funds.
Yeah.
So if they are the market, they said, there's little reason that they should be churning themselves so much. And they're trying to propose ideas of perhaps they should not turn over and churn so much of it, maybe just churn about 30% of their holdings in a year and be more long-term investors.
Right. Well, when I was working on a stockbroker, you get a daily report that shows you your trailing return on an equity of your accounts in terms of commissions. So the goal is to turn your money under management. You've got to extract at least 3% a year in commissions. That's a bare minimum. But the average in the office was 20 to 25%. So 20 to 25% of the equity gets churned and extracted through commissions. Doesn't mean that the accounts are automatically going to lose 20 to 25% a year, because at the same time you are engaging in all kinds of strategies to keep the level of equity constant. So at the end of the year, the client hopefully will either be break even or be up 5 or 6%. And you know, this is develops a whole growth industry within the firm of people working to sell to brokers money winning or money losing trades within the brokerage firm itself, for brokers to manage their portfolios and accounts so that they can keep that churn going. And of course, this phrase that I've mentioned on this show before is shear, don't slaughter. You know, you don't want to slaughter your clients. You want to keep them evergreen. You want to keep them continuously as a source of commission dollars. And you're managing this. One of the easiest ways to do it is through the initial public offering, the IPO market. This is why deals are priced so radically below what their fair market value is. And you see these stocks open up 10, 20, 30%, or during the IPO days, they'd be up 100% on the day one of their initial public offering, because you can go to clients that you've slaughtered, might be down 20, 30, 40, 50%, and you can make them whole by slipping shares of an IPO. This allows you to keep the laundry machine running. This is why deals are priced at the way that they are, to use it as basically payola. And it keeps things rolling. Again, you need a bull market for these to roll on. You need rates to continuously trade down as they were for 25 years. And this is all going up into 2007. But 2007, this all ended. And this is why it's all falling apart, because there's no way to bribe accounts anymore because you don't have these IPOs. The IPO window has been virtually shut. There hasn't been hardly any IPOs in the last 2 years, 3 years. But anyway, I was going to say about the banking industry is that it's basically, at the end of the day, the banking industry is nothing more than a utility. And you need to regulate it as a utility, and they need to price their services as a utility. And now, if your electric utility company, if the electric utility was marking up the electricity by those same amounts that the banks are marking up their capital, you know, you wouldn't tolerate it for 1 second. Although, since they now trade electric futures on commodity markets, they have, through the back door, given themselves a way to go around the fact that electricity and energy is supposed to be utility and utility pricing, thanks to futures pricing and market manipulations in the derivative markets. And we saw this with Enron. Companies took something that's a utility, very simple distribution of electricity at a price that's government regulated, because it functions in society as a whole, because people have a reliable cost for their energy and they can go and hire people to do stuff that's not in the business of manufacturing energy. And they got around all that, and they extracted rentier amounts of capital for themselves by abusing the system. And as Michael Hudson even says in the interview, he talks about banks that should be organized in the economy as utilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they also, I mean, you mentioned the stability, the certain, so having the stability of energy delivery and pricing and the stability of being able to get from point A to point B provides the context within which you can have entrepreneurship and capitalism. And that's another point about this article, is that all of this rentier, the banking sector became rentiers, feudal lords, basically,
mm-hmm.
from 1971. Of course, once we went off the gold standard, it became much more complex, the genuine value of what the currencies were. And it became very volatile. And you just need to look at any currency chart over the last 3 years or 4 years, even. I mean, those started going wild a few before the actual headline financial crisis began. The dollar was swinging all over the place. It would drop or fall or rise and by 15-20% in the course of 2 months. So that provides a lot of instability and churning,
mm-hmm.
because all of these, look at what has happened across, say, Milan or across all of America, all of these counties and municipalities. What are the biggest losses on derivatives? Currency swaps and interest rate swaps.
Mm-hmm.
So with all this volatility comes a perfect rentier system where they get to control the perception of volatility and the volatility in fact.
Right. Well, as the article points out, up until 1971, the average return on equity was 7%.
For a matter of 50 years.
Right. And the actuarial need for a pension fund to service the people who are getting payouts from those funds is about 7-8%. The average return on the stock market since the crash of 30s up until the 80s, 90s, and 2000s is approximately 7-8%.
Mm-hmm.
And the rate of inflation, natural inflation that occurs, has been probably not too far from that same number. You know, let's call it... 3-4%, let's say, inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So the biggest point to be made here is that those who manage large amounts of money, like pension accounts, all they need to understand is that the return that they can reasonably expect on their money is about 7%. Now the problem is that the people who manage these funds are not really terribly smart, and that's on purpose. They put people in place through political appointments and through friends. They give them a huge salary to sit there and just take orders from banks who sell them on this idea that they can get 10% or 11% or 12%. And you start chasing yield. And the common expression on Wall Street is that more people lost more money chasing yield than probably any other inducement toward greedy behavior. And chasing yield is very sexy. If you can go from 7-8 to 9-10%, it's an easy sale. And Mike Milken understood this. This is why the junk bond markets were created. The secondary, the creation of junk issuance was his revelation, because you, instead of waiting for a bond to be downgraded and offer a higher yield, you simply issue an original issue high yield bond to begin with. And he proved that a portfolio of this stuff would return better than treasuries. So he's pushing yield. He's selling yield. And the pension funds bought into it. And then he knew every single fund and every single bond, and he priced every single one, and he controlled the market. He controlled the making of that market, and he had a total monopoly position. And he totally transformed the corporate landscape of America, because you had guys like Ron Perlman coming in and saying, give me a few billion to buy Revlon. Ted Turner said, give me a few billion to start CNN. And they were able to raise this extraordinary amounts of money. For better or worse, MCI Communications, long distance company, challenged AT&T. So the chasing of the yield is a huge inducement. And ultimately, though, as the Milken's period ended up in the 87 crash, and reversion to the mean always asserts itself. You always get back to these numbers. Of 6%, 7% is a very, very high rate of return, considering it's above inflation, generally speaking. And that's all you really, that's your expectation. To run the returns at higher numbers, you see, this is the other problem. Is that, well, you say, what's wrong with running these, going after higher numbers, chasing yield, chasing return on equity, 20, 22%, 30%. What's wrong with that? Because unfortunately, what you run into is if you have huge pension funds and huge corporations gunning for 20, 22, 25% returns by taking extraordinary risks, these risks ultimately are taken out of the ecology. Because the ecology is the ultimate backstop to the economy. So when you see the BP disaster blow up, you see this new gas blow up in Pennsylvania, you see the Massey mine blow up in the U.S., you see the Bhopal disaster, you see the general trend toward ecological holocaust in the seas and the land and the air. This is because of this attempt to extract returns that the ecology simply cannot sustain. And so forget about the lost money, because money can be remade at some point. But if you terminally kill the ecology, and so that it no longer supports human life as we know it, and you destroy the habitat for humans on planet Earth, as is happening in real time right now, and anyone who really doesn't see that happening is delusional, you've basically caused premature human extinction. And now some may argue that's a good thing too, because humans ultimately have proven to be a bit of never got out of the beta phase. But
well, but humans also are like that baby elephant tied to the tree with a little rope, who grows up to be a big, powerful elephant, still thinking that they can't break from the little tiny rope or knock the tree down. So that also brings me to the final bit about this time for a rent cut, is that basically, they're saying it is in the hands of these very same citizens who are trying to lobby their own government to do something to stop the bankers, and the bankers in turn hire their own lobbyists to prevent the banks, the politicians, from doing anything and offer them great jobs once they get out of government. Well, basically, the economist is saying your funds are the market. Yeah. You can tell your pension fund to only buy things that are they have the power to refuse to pay performance fees or invest in alternative assets such as hedge funds and private equity, and to invest only in securities traded on public exchanges. So right now there's this big debate going on in the U.S. and about financial reform, and it's been removed, the clause that would force CDOs to be traded on a public exchange, as a saying. So you could force your own pension fund to invest only in securities traded on a public exchange. So no structured products like the infamous collateralized debt obligations. So yeah. by refusing to give them your money for these products, they refuse to tell you what the ingredients are.
Yeah, well, this is the lottery ticket syndrome. You know, people will never proactively argue against being sold lottery tickets, especially when they don't have to pay to buy those lottery tickets. The purchase price of those lottery tickets are subsidized by the government and by the taxpayer and by the banks themselves. The banks loan the fund managers money to buy into their schemes, just like China loans Americans the money to buy their cheap stuff that goes into Walmart.
Yeah, well, it's also a Ponzi, a typical Ponzi, just like Bernie Madoff's clients. They knew his returns were not normal. They knew they were out of the normal range, and yet they continued investing with him and pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into his fund because they thought he was doing it illegally and they wanted in on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's no organization. There's no pension fund managers organization that gets together every week or every month or every 6 months to discuss this problem or discuss this situation. They have some lobbying groups and they have trade magazines and, but there's nobody actually, there's no leader. Do they mention the name of a leader? Did they say Joe Blow, who manages $14 billion for the United Pensioners Workers Association, said ... Was there a quote in there? No, because there is no leader. There's nobody in the entire industry who has a leading voice against abuse that they're suffering.
I bet you anything that you're going to see when you invest with a pension fund, they're going to start telling you to tick one of these boxes. You want me as your pension fund manager to invest in opaque products that could that have a very high chance of being fraudulent, but you might actually gain something from it. Or B, you want me to invest in transparent products that are listed on an exchange. Well, it'll be interesting to see what people would choose if they themselves had to be responsible for what the choices were, instead of pretending to be a victim for this level that this like barrier that allows you to be a victim. Pretend that you were a victim of these people.
Well, you know, you have a really good example of that right now, because British Petroleum, which is held by most pensions in the UK,
yes,
is saying that they will not cut their dividend. They're doing everything they can not to cut their dividend, because they have the pensioners are electing to facilitate an environmental holocaust, and they're not electing to try to rein in the abuses of an environmental holocaust provoker. And so you have an example of this right now. The pensioners, nobody in the BP pension accounts is standing up to say, we want you to cut that dividend because we value our lives over the profits coming in from these dividends. They are suicide consumers, suicide bankers that hew toward a suicidal ideology of market fundamentalism, and they're committing premature human extinction.
So there was another thing I just read in the paper today now BP has tried golf balls. They tried tires.
Yeah.
They got a saw stuck in there. And now another option is they're going to try hay.
Yeah.
There's talk of putting hay there, which, you know, fine. Okay, some old-fashioned stuff might work. But the fact is, Barack Obama spewed onto the public BP's own propaganda a few months ago, saying that, you know, we could drill 5,000 feet below the surface of the sea and then 18,000 feet below the surface of the bottom of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll all be fine because we have amazing high-tech equipment to deal with this. But if they're talking about hanging golf balls, we've known about these things for hundreds of years, sometimes thousands.
Well, you know, we know that there's a $500,000 piece of equipment that is required in other countries to be installed along with these deep water drilling in case there's an accident to shut the well down. BP, because the U.S. doesn't require this piece of equipment, decided to save $500,000. And as a result, they are complicit in the Holocaust. And Barack Obama is giving it his blessing, his good graces.
There's also another thing I just learned is that, so Norway and Brazil, again, they require that $500,000 piece of equipment that is basically a blowout preventer, or it automatically shuts it out. It's when the explosion causes it to shut it down, the sound of the explosion. And then they also require at least a second pipe. They require multiple pipes.
Yeah.
So this one is a single point of failure, of course, because American capitalism is, they love single points of failure, even though they're not supposed to have that, you would think, in real free market capitalism.
Well, it's a terrorist attack. I mean, it's very simple. British Petroleum and Tony Hayward committed a terrorist attack against America, an ecological eco-terrorism. That's a true eco-terrorist. Somebody blowing up an SUV because they don't like what the oil companies are doing is an activist who's committing a crime. They're not an eco-terrorist. Tony Hayward, who negligently, premeditatedly, does not avail himself to the core safety function features of his drilling, is engaging in an act that by any reasonable definition, constitutes eco-terrorism, and the result is a holocaust of life, marine life, and soon to be human life. Now, how many people will die? Many people. How many people does the oil industry engage in their mass holocaust? Many, many people. So Barack Obama has given his tacit approval and given his blessing to a holocaust in the name of profit. And in the past, this is exactly the same reason that was given for previous Holocausts. People say, well, we can't stop at these Holocausts because we make too much money out of it. The profits are too great. We have to continue. This is the exact same thinking, exact same people, bringing you the exact same nightmare.
Well, there is that.
Now, here's something from the Financial Times, which is very interesting. I wanted to touch on this because it's a very good historical situation here.
Oh, yeah.
From something called The New Rules for Nations in Hoc. I keep reading. This is by Alan Beatty. He says, I keep reading it everywhere that Greece is the new Lehman Brothers. Further unwelcome evidence that the X is the new Y. Construction, having long escaped its original ghetto in the fashion pages, has now colonized the entirety of English language journalism. He's referring to, like, you know, black is the new black type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Trouble is, if we're going to start playing historical public-private bankruptcy snap, the game will never end. Lehman itself was the new Argentina of 2001. Argentina was the new Credit Anstalt of 1931. Credit Anstalt was the new previous Argentina of 1890. The previous Argentina was the new South Sea Company of 1720, which was the new Philip II of Spain, who through his multiple defaults of 1557, 1560, 1575, and 1596, managed repeatedly to be the new himself. Governments and bankers have been merrily tossing the bankruptcy baton back and forth for half a millennium. With all this experience in going broke, you would expect a common set of regulations to have emerged. But no, for some reason, and at this stage, I'm afraid it's too early to rule out self-interest, governments insist on being tougher on financiers than on themselves. Time for some consistency. If Greece is the new Lehman, the new rules for banks should become the new rules for sovereigns. Here's my four-point plan. And he gives us 4 points, which include too big to fail, the Volcker rule, limits on unsecured borrowing, and a global bank levy. So this is in today's Financial Times by Alan Beatty. I recommend you look at it.
Too big to fail. So countries should break up into smaller units.
Well, in other words, The crisis is been recurring for hundreds of years. It's the same cycle of inflation, deflation, boom and bust, greed and fear. And there are ways you can deal with it, and there's plenty of ways you can deal with it. And my point is that what makes it unique than the South Sea bubble, for example, or these other historical examples, is that in this crisis of 2010 is part of a twin catastrophe, which is the economic ecologic disaster. And once the ecologic disaster fully unfolds, there's no coming back from that at all, not for 10,000 years. So this is why people ask me, you know, I went from Wall Street to being kind of anti-Wall Street. What was the trigger? And the trigger was when I understood that the risk was not economic, but ecological. Ecological risk was the trigger that put me on the other side of this debate. And nothing that's happened in the last 8 years or 10 years has dissuaded me from this point of view. In fact, it's only become more of a factor. And this is why when folks argue against global warming, et cetera, I don't have any truck with that because it's insane. If you're arguing against the global warming and climate change, you are, you know, just outright delusional. There's absolutely no hope for you.
Well, speaking of outright delusional, let's move on to the final segment, and that's the Gaza flotilla. So more information has emerged.
Massacre.
Yeah.
The flotilla massacre.
Well, there are right now, the media is telling you it's 9 dead, correct?
Yeah.
Now, the initial reports were 16, and that quickly got changed to what Israel said was 9. But according to the reports today, there are 6 activists still missing. So they're saying that the death toll may rise if these people are actually dead.
Right.
And if they're still hiding them, I'm assuming that they're from nations that Israel doesn't want to know these citizens died.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, U.S. and Turk citizens don't matter, so they're going to be they'll release those bodies. But so of the nine dead,
yeah,
that the IDF killed in self-defense, they say five of them were shot in the back of the head or back at close range.
Tony Soprano style.
Tony Soprano style. Yeah, the only thing missing were the cement boots.
Yeah.
Killed the guy in self-defense. He has his cement boots on. And
right.
But this is like, of course it's outrageous. And we see this all the time, though. We've seen it. You know, our populations, we do accept this as legitimate self-defense. We saw this with the acquiescence of the populations when U.S. soldiers occupying a foreign country use the same argument in self-defense. They said that they had to kill the man who was handcuffed, bound, and gagged on the floor. They were just acting in self-defense.
Uh-huh.
We've seen this in Guantanamo. Those four people... apparently murdered. Mm-hmm. The information came out, and America came out and said that these guys committed suicide and it was an act of asymmetric warfare. So, you know, you see it in many of the comments across.
Like, America and Israel are involved in a bad marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bad marriage. And they need to get a divorce.
Well, but this is another important story tied with this. So on the flotilla thing, there were some Americans, including former UN ambassadors and, a survivor of the USS Liberty, mm-hmm. which was bombed in 1967, carpet bombed, basically, by Israel. And it was a U.S. ship where 34 U.S. soldiers died, which you're not allowed to talk about in the U.S. But Representative Brad Sherman, Democrat of California, says that he is seeking the prosecution of any U.S. citizens who are aboard or involved with a Freedom Flotilla under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is exactly what happened in the fascism of the first Great Depression.
Right.
Is nations started applying death penalties against their own traitors, and the barrier... For the bar for what it meant to be a traitor mm-hmm. was lowered and lowered and lowered.
That's right.
Until they just were killing. It first started killing out just a few thousand people, maybe a few hundred, or executing them. And it was everybody supported it because they were communists. That's how the Germans started out. And we wanted to get rid of the menace of communists. Now it's the menace of terrorists, and it's applied towards many, many people, whether they're Islamic or eco-terrorists, they call people who blow up SUVs.
Yeah, the slippery slope. You know, they keep lowering the bar, as you say, in terms of defining who's a terrorist.
So in this case, he wants to apply the death penalty to these U.S. citizens who are aboard these boats trying to help deliver humanitarian goods to the people of Gaza.
Yeah. I mean, the sad thing is that if the bull market were still running, none of this would be going on, because on the margins, a little money would get into the Gaza and the occupied territories, and it wouldn't be as horrible as it is. But because there's a global depression, all the marginal money for aid to different countries, you see that I believe African countries were saying that the developed world had pulled back on all their aid commitments.
Yeah, the Bob Geldof 2005 Glenn Eagles aid commitments, when right. he hailed that he had saved the world, and that therefore his record sales should double, and his right. stock price should be higher. Remember this?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, apparently they've actually retracted all of that
right.
this last year. They're not giving their aid, they said.
Right. So, you see, so the money is dried up. And it's not on the margins trickling into these tertiary, periphery spots that are hot spots that can be quite nettlesome. And the folks who are now calling for increase in the death penalty are looking with blinkers, because they don't understand, really, that the problem is not political. It's not ideological. The problem is economic. The problem is that the banks are imploding and credit has evaporated, and that the world is heading into a global credit crunch depression. And what they are doing, instead of facing the truth about that and what needs to be done economically, which would be a rebalance the global economy and claw back some of the hundreds and billions and trillions that were stolen by banks and their friends, they are creating scapegoats.
Well, the scapegoating is certainly happening wide. And
yeah, so you've got this massive scapegoating going on, and it's a slippery slope. And as you point out, there's historical precedent for it. The folks are initially just kind of looked down upon, and then they're pretty soon that their licenses to do business are removed. Then they are put into a ghetto. Then they're asked to wear identifying clothing to identify them. And it just keeps going down this path. And the insanity is normalized with that every step of the way. You know, it reminds me, I just had a flash of a thought. I remember back in the early days of the internet when people were passing viral thing photos and videos around. There was one at the time that was very interesting. This was back in 1996, 97. It was a photo montage of the mugshots of a woman through 20 years of being a crack whore in Los Angeles. And they showed her first mugshot to her last mugshot. And the progression from perky young gal to hag strung out on crack was, you know, revolting, you know, and shocking. But at every single step of the way, you know that in her mind, she normalized her behavior and accepted it and looked in the mirror, thought that, well, it's not that bad. And this is what these developed countries are doing now. They're looking in the mirror, and even though they're engaged in genocide, they're engaged in eco-holocaust, eco-terrorism, they're looking and they're saying to themselves, well, it's not that bad. And they're going down this incredible slippery slope toward similar to that gap hole that opened up the jaws of hell in that town just the last week.
Guatemala.
This is something out of a Caravaggio painting.
Caravaggio.
What did I say? Baccio?
Carpaccio.
Something out of a Carpaccio. Plate of Carpaccio with some Parmesan cheese.
Well, that's what the global economy and geopolitics has become, a plate of Carpaccio, according to Max Kaiser.
Yes, all of my art references are strained through the utterances of discredited movie directors in the pages of the Financial Times weekend section, making references to Caravaggio.
Caravaggio. Oui. There's a great Caravaggio directly across from the Mona Lisa, if you're ever in the Louvre.
Oh, really?
Well, it was. I think
That's a bad place to be. The Caravaggio must be pissed off about that.
Well, it's much better than the Mona Lisa.
Well, who looks at it, though?
But they moved the Mona Lisa, didn't they?
They have a view of many back of the head of many Japanese heads, back of their heads.
Anyway, it's a quite
breathtaking. When are we going back to the Louvre? We haven't been there in a few years.
It's at least 7 years.
There's a good restaurant across the street.
Indeed there is.
Now, what else we got going on that's coming up this week?
Well, we have Michael Hudson on the show on Tuesday. We have David DeGraw. We're going to talk about his piece on the flash crash thing and his conversations with him. He's got some responses from congressmen. And we're talking to, this is for Danny. We're talking to Mike Ruppert. And we're next week we're talking to John Authors, speaking of the Financial Times.
Oh yeah, they review his book in the Times today.
It's a fantastic book. We genuinely recommend it.
The Rise of Markets or something? Here it is.
The Fearful Rise of Markets.
The Fearful Rise of Markets. A Short View of Global Bubbles and Synchronized Meltdowns by John Authors. I read this book 2 weeks ago and it's 200 pages of pure bliss. Anyone who wants to know what's going on, get a copy of this
very
book.
Very simply puts it in an easy to understand language. And
well, you know, it is the language is extraordinarily precise. Mm-hmm. It's well written. You see, that's the key. I mean, it's not like Peter Schiff will write a book that's a children's book with cartoons and try to explain things. But that's not what we're talking. It's well written.
Yes. Well, also, well, of course, Peter Schiff and many people will get very emotional, and you can see their bias very clearly across the page.
It's ease of exposition and clarity of content.
Ah, yeah, that's how I would put it. That's a good way to put it.
Yes, it says, the clarity of design makes it unlikely that authors found inspiration in the economic shelf of the local bookshop. Rather, the volume most resembles E.H. Gombrich's international bestseller, A Little History of the World, published in 1935, and its ease of exposition and clarity of content. You see what I'm saying? It's a masterpiece. Masterwork.
It is. It is. So we're interviewing him in 3 or 4 episodes' time, I guess. Yeah.
And so then we have... Did we play the episode yet with... it's on the web now. Paul Craig Roberts.
It will be up. Yes, it's up today, actually.
I think it's up today, yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, that was a good one, too. So, yeah, so there's lots of content, and I guess we're going to be back right here on Resonance 104.4 FM, by the way. We forgot to mention that anytime during this hour so far, in case you didn't know what you were listening to.
What other shows they got? We got 2 more minutes. What other shows they got on Resonance, aside from the Naked Short Club?
Not sure at all.
They got this show.
By the way, I want to say one other trend that we've been talking about is how the college industrial complex, and now we see that Ponzi scheme ripping apart blowing up. The Ponzi scheme is melting down. It's melting down here in the UK.
Oh, yeah, tell the people.
Data release shows government lost £600 million in bad debts in last year.
Yeah.
And a large part of it is due to students unable to pay their government-backed loans.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing is happening in the U.S. Apparently, 50% of private student loans for private universities are defaulting.
That's good. You know, Peter Schiff will say that's good because it'll bring the price of education down because it was artificially pumped up through these loan programs that it just didn't give higher education. It wasn't made more accessible for more people. It just made it more expensive and less accessible.
Well, it made it more expensive, and it also made it degraded it. Apparently, the quality of the education, not only have so many people have bachelor's degrees now anyway, so it forces you to have to get a master's or PhD to get even like a relatively low entry job.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the quality of the education is therefore a lot less as well.
Yeah, it's a bad situation. So the market is correcting, and the politicians, what they should do is honestly tell people that for 2 or 3 years, there has to be a massive correction, and all the debt has to be written off, and we have to start all over again. But they won't, so it'll drag on, and there'll be the creation of scapegoats who will be unnecessarily, unfairly herded into ghettos and persecuted for no reason. Bye, y'all.